eschatology. This comes from the Greek root eschaton, which means last. And so eschatology, logi, logos, is the study of the last things. We're doing biblical eschatology. There's actually, in the physical sciences, there's a cosmological eschatology, how the universe is going to end. This is biblical eschatology, which is the study of what the Bible teaches about the final things. As we open up on this subject, when people approach eschatology, they usually approach it with two different extremes. Or maybe you're just slanted toward one or the other. The first extreme would be gullibility. I doubt that many of us are going to be gullible when it comes to this topic. We're usually a lot more wired in the other direction. And yet, Bible-believing churches somehow produce weird, wacky, eschatology Bible teachers and prophecy nuts. And so they must come from somewhere, so we need to think about this, not turning weird on prophecy. The great Baptist preacher William Miller served in the 19th century. He was convinced, based on Daniel chapter 8, in the 2300 evenings and mornings, he worked out this prediction that the end of the world and Jesus' second coming would occur in 1844. His followers, who were dubbed the Millerites, were so convinced about this en masse. They quit their jobs. They worked full-time for the church. They just tried to reach as many people as possible, anticipating that on a certain day, Jesus was going to come back in 1844. This came to be known as the Great Disappointment. The Watchtower and Bible Tract Society, the Jehovah's Witnesses, have predicted the second coming of Christ numerous times. You read through their literature, which is to them almost like apostolically inspired. I mean, what the Watchtower and Bible Tract Society writes is considered inspired, and they have inspired multiple prophecies about the second coming of Jesus. 1877, the end is near. It's going to happen this year. 1894, never mind, 1894 is the year. Came and went. 1904, 1914, 1933, 1939. They have had so many different false predictions about the second coming of Christ. These days, Jehovah's Witnesses have just said, well, Jesus did return, and yet it was a spiritual return in the heavenly tabernacle. And so if you ask a Jehovah's Witness, what about all these predictions? Well, they were fulfilled. They had to have been. But these happened in heaven. That's how they get around it. Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses have lost millions of people, consequently. Back in 1988, Edgar Wisenant, who was a Christian Bible teacher, he came out with a book called 88 Reasons That Jesus Will Return in 1988. You might be thinking to yourself, well, what about Matthew 24:36? No one knows the day or the hour, not even the Son nor the angels, but the Father alone. That's one of his first reasons. He has to address that. He deals with that. He says, well, Jesus said no one knows the day or the hour, and what he was referring to is that there is a time change, like from here to China or from here to California, and so no one can really know the day or the hour, because what's 7 o'clock here could be 10 o'clock someplace else, and it could be another day on the other side of the world, and so that's what Jesus meant by that. Well, Edgar Wisenant sold 4.5 million copies of this book. 1988 came and went. Jesus never returned. He came out with another book in 1989, 89 Reasons Jesus Will Return in 1989. Still sold decently well, not as well as the first one. More recently, Harold Camping, very popular Bible teacher, radio program, big ministry. He predicted, I believe it was May 21st, 2011. That was the first time I ever taught this class. And he predicted that Jesus was going to return halfway through the time I was teaching this class. So I told the class on the first week, hey, we won't be here week five because Harold Camping says we won't. So his people, they were passing out pamphlets. They had SUVs, save the date, May 21st. They had full-size billboards, parades, May 21st, 2011 came and went. Jesus never came. The church never went. And Harold Camping stayed in his home for 2 weeks, wouldn't respond to the news, wouldn't talk to people. He died of a stroke, I think a couple months later. So we don't want to be gullible. We don't want to be sucked away by false, crazy Bible prophecy teachers. On the other hand, we don't want to be cynical. The Bible teaches the second coming of Christ. In fact, our cynicism itself was predicted. 2 Peter 3:3. Peter says, in the last days, scoffers will come. He could have said cynics. Scoffers. They will say, what happened to the promise that Jesus is coming again? From before the times of our ancestors, everything has remained the same since the world was first created. This is the view of stasis. It's the world has always been the way it is, and it will always be the way it is. The Bible, like modern science, agrees that with the view that time is linear. So think of Paul in Romans 13. Today is closer to the day of salvation. That implies A to B is a linear sequence. We're moving toward a goal. We're moving forward in time. Many worldviews in the day that the Bible was written had a cyclical view of time. They believed that time basically restarted. So think of like the oscillating universe. It blows up, comes back together ad infinitum, over and over and over and over. So what has happened will keep happening, or just that static stoic view that the universe has just always been here, always will be here. And Peter says, not true. Scoffers are going to say, apparently Peter was privy to the idea that there's going to be some time before Jesus returns, enough time that people are going to start to say, he's never coming back. Jesus himself said in Matthew 24:4, he said, see to it that no one misleads you, for many will come in my name and will mislead many. Like flies flock to dung, Jesus predicted that this specific portion of his teaching about the end of human history would be met with some of the worst crackpots, fanatics, and false teachers. And he says, many, many will come. So apparently this is going to be a part of theology and study where false teachers are going to flock to this. And he says, don't be misled. The 19th century Christian philosopher Soren Kierkegaard wrote this. He said, a fire broke out backstage in a theater. The clown came out to warn the public. They thought it was a joke and applauded. He repeated it. The acclaim was even greater. He writes, I think that's just how the world will come to an end, to general applause from wits who believe it's a joke. I wonder about that. I wonder if he's right, that we're so inundated with false prophecy, false teachers, that it just seems like, oh, here we go again. It's a joke. It's never going to happen. There's been all these predictions. They've never happened until finally it does happen. And Jesus says, it's going to happen. Personally, I feel pretty uncomfortable with the sensationalism, especially in the dispensational camp. That's the camp of which I'm a part. Many dispensationalist teachers and theologians have been guilty of sensationalism, that they go too far. They predict things too much. And so there is kind of that uncomfortable sense of guilt by association, which we have to weather. On the other hand, what's the alternative? You know, when you think about this, heretics, false teachers, have attacked every portion of God's truth. Or let me ask that a different way. What area of theology have heretics not tried to distort? The deity of Christ, the Trinity, the church, everything, every single thing, they've tried to distort it. So why wouldn't they attack this area too? The best way to be prepared against fanaticism, sensationalism, and false teaching isn't to retreat from the topic. That would leave you more vulnerable. The best solution is actually to move toward the topic, to know it better than the false teachers, so as to not be duped. This is an important topic, eschatology. For one, the Bible is 27% predictive prophecy. I get that statistic from Walter Kaiser, Old Testament scholar. I've heard different figures. I've heard 25%, 27%. I've never studied it. I've never counted, but I'm inclined to agree. It's quite a bit. Now, much of that prophecy has already been fulfilled. So think of all the times in the Gospels where Jesus says the Son of Man is going to be taken into Jerusalem, handed over to evil men. He's going to be scourged, crucified, and killed, and will be raised on the third day. At the time that Jesus spoke that, that was prophecy. Okay, see, for us, we skip over this so much. Think about when Noah was predicting the end of the world in Genesis 6, building an ark. That was predictive prophecy. God was saying, it's going to come to an end. My spirit will not strive with man forever. So for a Bible reader today, you look over that and you're like, well, yeah, that was prophecy back then. Well, then again, at the time, they didn't know that was going to be fulfilled. Looking back retrospectively, we see it's been fulfilled 10 times out of 10. So for people who say, well, yeah, I really like the Bible and I want to study the Bible, I just don't want to study prophecy. Well, the Bible is a book of prophecy. If you take out prophecy, you're taking out a quarter, one out of four verses. The second coming of Jesus is mentioned 300 times, according to Dr. Robert Saucy, who is a professor, I believe, at Dallas Theological. Or, to put that in a different perspective, one out of 25 verses refers to the second coming of Jesus. The point I'm making here is that this isn't just a biblical teaching. This is a biblical emphasis. An emphasis. It's constantly being taught on. The second coming is mentioned 8 more times than the first coming in the Old Testament. So, we see all these predictions about the first coming, and Bible believers of all stripes will say, well, yeah, those are literally fulfilled in the person of Jesus. Well, there's 8 times more prophecies about his return. We're not supposed to study that. We're not supposed to know that, interpret that. Another point that Mark Hitchcock makes in his excellent book on this topic, it's called The End, he says, why does John refer to his book as a revelation if nothing is revealed? Think about that. What's being revealed? Well, we can't really know what the book of Revelation is all about. Then what was revealed? Why is it that in Revelation 1:3, John says, he says, the words of this book, if you read them, just reading them brings a blessing. It's the only book in the Bible that gives you that promise, that if you just read this book, you will be blessed as a consequence. Paul, when he was in Thessalonica, he could have only been there a couple months, tops. He writes in 1 Thessalonians 5:1 about times and dates, we do not need to write to you, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. Wait a minute. You're telling me that Paul was in Thessalonica for 2 months. What do you cover with new believers in 2 months' time? Paul covered eschatology. This was one of the things he thought was important enough that if he had 2 months to teach a group of new believers, eschatology was one of the subjects he would cover. He doesn't just say that you would know this well. You know it very well. How about in 2 Thessalonians 2:5? Don't you remember me telling you these things when I was with you? He's like, we talked about this. We covered this. Were you on Facebook during LTC that week? What were you doing? 1 Peter 4:7, Peter says, the end of all things is near. So you might say, yeah, this is a really esoteric, maybe academic, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin kind of a question. But Peter says, the end of all things is near. Therefore, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer. Peter's actually making the claim that because we know that the return of Christ is near, it could happen at any minute, that this actually has an effect, a necessary effect, on our prayer life, on our judgment, the way we think about the world. Now this is going to get confusing. Stanley Toussaint was a professor of theology. He was doing work at the graduate level on the book of Revelation, teaching these grad students how to handle this book and the genre and the background and the apocalyptic imagery and the extra-biblical material and the Old Testament allusions and the Greek and the different perspectives. And he was doing a semester-long course on this for his students, his grad students. He tells the story one night he was out after hours locking up at his office and he came across the janitor cleaning up. And he was taking a break, eating his dinner. He looked down over his shoulder and he was friends with this guy. He looked over, he saw the janitor was reading the book of Revelation. So Toussaint was interested. He said, "So you're reading the book of Revelation, huh? What are you getting out of that?" And he says, "Oh, it's awesome." He said, "Do you understand it?" The janitor said, "Oh, of course I understand it." He said, "Well, what's it mean?" He said, "Oh, it means we're going to win." Good point. This dude wasn't a scholar. He didn't, you know, take a graduate level class. You read the book of Revelation. Most of the things in there are actually pretty clear. The main points are clear. It's the details that are difficult to discern. So I just want you to remember that as we go through this quarter. There's a lot of things that you're going to be like, okay, when does this happen? And how does that happen? And what timing? And are we going to be there? And all these different details. Okay, that's where the debate comes in. The big points, the main points, are going to be very clear. And you're going to see that with time. Let's think about some hermeneutical principles. So we already went through these in our reading this week, right? Some principles of hermeneutics or interpretation. The first would be that you assume a literal interpretation. Now, in your reading, you read from Cornelius Venema. He was making the, in my estimation, the straw man argument that people who hold to this hermeneutical principle believe that we should treat everything literally in the Bible. Is that true? No. Nobody believes that. All right? Everybody believes that the Bible is filled with similes, with sarcasm, with symbolism. I mean, they believe that there's different genres, there's metaphor, there's allegory. When you approach different books, you realize that they're written in different genres to different people, with different idioms, different idiomatic expressions. And so we don't treat every Bible verse literally. That's a straw man argument, not true, it's false. This principle is saying that we assume a literal interpretation. In other words, the burden of proof rests on the interpreter who claims, "I don't believe that that's literal." If you don't assume it, then the Bible becomes putty in the hands of the interpreter. You can make it say whatever you want. We have to assume it's literal, and then the individual who's saying, "No, I think that's symbolism," they would have to demonstrate why they believe that's the case. It raises another question. How do we identify symbols? Well, there's a few ways to do this. For one, does a literal reading lead to contradictions or even nonsense? In Revelation 4 and 5, Jesus is called the Lamb of God, and he's also called the Lion. Wait a minute. Are we saying that Jesus is two different animal species? Is that what that means? How could he be a lamb-lion? A lion-lamb. How would you paint a picture like that if you were trying to capture like a really furry, sweet, soft lion? A really mean-looking lamb? No, those images would be contradictory. And so, honestly, this is a lot easier to discern than you might think. We do this all the time. When somebody says, "Oh, it's so cold, I'm freezing out here," they're not saying my core temperature went below 32 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a metaphor, okay? It's an expression. Obviously, we can't be contradictory. It can't lead to nonsense. We want to see the immediate context so we can identify a symbol in this way. Then how do we interpret it? Well, look at the context. You know, Revelation chapter 1, it refers to the seven lampstands. Oh, well, what are those? Oh, if only we knew. You read a couple verses later, John says those are the churches. The churches are the lampstands. A lot of symbolism is this way. Actually, not that hard to interpret. The Bible itself is has been said, is its best interpreter. Just read the context. If you can't understand the symbol from the context, then you need to look at the greater context of the author, John, let's say, if you're reading the book of Revelation, or the greater New Testament context, and if you still can't identify it, the Old Testament context. Is there something from the Old Testament that would show us what this means? So you can think of Revelation chapter 12, where it says that an eagle took the people of Israel out to the wilderness for 1260 days and so forth. Dispensational interpreters have said, well, the new helicopter aircraft, they're called the Eagles. And so that must mean that the United States is going to come in and airlift all of the Jewish people out into the wilderness for protection. Come on. Okay, in the Old Testament, we have God being thought of as an eagle, covering over his people with eagle's wings. We're thinking, of course, of like Exodus 19 or the Psalms. So we want to look to the Old Testament or the New. It's usually best if you can start with the book or the author or the Testament. It's probably a good place to start. We also want to appeal to the historical context. Is there something from history at the time that would help us to understand what that symbol meant? What we don't want to do is switch the order of operations here. This is my critique of many theologians and interpreters. They'll jump to the extra-biblical literature, like they'll jump to 1 Maccabees, or they'll jump to the pseudepigrapha, or the apocrypha, or the apocalyptic literature of the day to interpret the book of Revelation. So you can have whole commentaries that are interpreting the book of Revelation through the lens of extra-biblical, non-Christian, apocalyptic literature. Now, I think that's fair to appeal to extra-biblical literature to get some comparisons. I actually think it's a good practice. We just don't want to trump the immediate context and the biblical context for some kind of extra-biblical source. Now, why would I say that? I say that because the New Testament cites from the Old Testament something like 600 times. It never cites from the Apocrypha once. So if we're going to be inclined, if we're going to be moved in a certain direction toward wondering where the New Testament authors are gravitating, I'm going to put my money on the Old Testament, right? Not on the ascension of Isaiah, the Testament of Levi, these pseudepigraphal apocalyptic works from before or even after the time of Christ. So historical context is fair. It just shouldn't trump the biblical context. We know the New Testament authors were steeped in the Old. We don't know if they were thinking of these other works. And we want to make sure that whatever interpretation we come up with doesn't abrogate the spirit of the symbol. Think of Revelation chapter 9, where it says that a third of the waters turned to blood. What on earth does that mean? It could mean that there's some sort of nuclear war happening at the time that poisons the water. It says that they drink from the water and it's poison. That a torch lands in the water, spoils the water, kills a third of the aquatic life. Okay? It could be that this is a symbol hearkening back to the Exodus and the plagues. Water turning into blood, the Nile turning into blood. That's a possibility. It could be just some kind of general judgment. We don't really know what it means. But what we wouldn't want to conclude, as some interpreters have concluded, well, this refers to the Roman Catholic Church taking over during the conquest of 1563, or whatever it is. That's not the spirit of the symbol. How do we go from poisoning the waters to, oh, this refers to the Crusades, or this refers to the persecution of Martin Luther? That's jumping from the spirit of the symbol into a novel interpretation. Some of the interpretive keys that you're going to need to unlock prophecy are right here. We're going to go through these right here. Types, type gaps, time gaps, and unforeseen partial fulfillment. Now, you read about these, right? So this is review. Good. Type, I like to use the word prototype. Tupos in the Greek And anti-tupas, it just means that it's like a mold going into clay. The way we usually use this term, type, is almost like you'd use the modern term for an engineer, prototype. That I'm creating something, you know, at Tesla, some kind of car that gets a million miles to the battery or whatever. And I'm making a prototype to show that it's not like this is the final product, but it's a prototype that will become the final product. So when we look to our Bibles, we see many examples of this. Think of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, the father, takes Isaac, the son, up on the mountain to sacrifice him to God. The angel of the Lord stops him mid-stride, says, "Don't do that. Now I know that you fear me." And instead of a lamb being the substitute, a ram is the substitute. And then in verse 18 of Genesis 22, it says, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." Jehovah Jireh. That's a type. That's a type. It's saying something will happen on this mountain in the future. Or think of Hebrews 11, where the author of Hebrews points to this and says, yes, he received Isaac back as a tupos, a type. How does this serve as a type or a prototype for Jesus? Well, it's the picture of a father sacrificing his son to please God. Sacrificing his only son. The son is a willing participant. He's not forced against his will. Abraham has to wait 3 days knowing that his son is as good as dead. And where did this all happen? It happened on Mount Moriah, just to the north of which is where they built the temple. This is a picture of Jesus' sacrifice, God's only son. You get the point. The Passover. Killing an innocent lamb, putting the blood over the posts of the doors so that the angel of death would pass over in judgment. That's a picture of Jesus. The tabernacle, the priests, the Ark of the Covenant. All of these things are pictures. They're foreshadowing. They're prototypes. They prefigure what Jesus would do. So those are types. With me so far? Then there's time gap prophecies. This is the best illustration I've ever heard on this. It's like you're looking at two mountains. And the near mountain is tiny and the far mountain is huge. But from the viewer's perspective, it looks like these two mountains are right next to each other. As you finally go hiking up to the first precipice, you discover there's a huge gap in between. I mean, sometimes when you're hiking in the mountains, you just feel like if I had an NFL quality football, I could just throw this football at that mountain peak. And then you discover it's 10 miles away. You're not even close. Well, the same thing is true with the time gap prophecy. Think about Jesus, what he taught in Luke 4. He opens up the scroll of Isaiah 61. He starts to read. He stops halfway through Isaiah 61, verse 2a, and stops without reading verse 2b. Halfway through a Hebrew couplet. It would be like saying, roses are red, violets are blue, your feet are smelly, and yeah, and just, everyone's just saying that, are you going to finish it? He says, yeah, the day of the year of Jubilee has come upon you, and he stops right before saying, and the day of God's vengeance is going to come. So Jesus saw that there was a gap in between the first coming and the second coming, halfway through a verse. So where did you come up with this idea of time gap prophecies? From Jesus Christ. That's who. Think of Isaiah chapter 9. Unto us a child will be born. Who's that? Jesus. And the government will rest on his shoulders. That hasn't happened yet. So there must be at least a 2,000 year gap between Isaiah 9:6 and Isaiah 9:7. I mean, right in the middle. Now the prophet couldn't see that. He's like the guy walking on the mountains. Looking out, he couldn't see the gap in between. Type gap prophecies. These type of prophecies are where you have a type and an anti-type. So this would be like type prophecies, prototypes, that sort of thing. But in addition, you have a gap of time in between. So the prophet will start to talk about this figure, and as he starts to talk about the figure, all of a sudden, he continues to talk about the figure, and you realize, wait a minute, that can't be referring to the same figure. Who's he talking about there? only to discover that he's talking about another figure, and there's a gap of time in between. The best example of this is Antiochus Epiphanes IV, a person to whom we'll return next week. He was a vicious, evil, wicked, Gentile murderer, tyrant. He comes into the temple during the days of the Maccabees, 165, 164 BC. He kicks down the door. He brings in a swine, sacrifices the blood of a pig, a swine, in the Holy of Holies, in the Jewish temple. Oh my God. What do Jewish people at that time think about swine? They're not fans. What do they think about Gentile tyrants coming into the Holy of Holies rather than the high priest? They're not in favor. So what do they call this? They call it the abomination of desolation. Daniel chapter 8. But as we get to the end of Daniel chapter 8, the author, Daniel, tells us this is actually dealing with the distant future. How can that be the case? Once we get to Daniel chapter 11, we're going to study this next week, we discover that he's really launching into the future. The beginning of Daniel 11 is talking about, you know, the time period back during the time of the Greeks, and then all of a sudden it flashes forward to the time of the resurrection of the dead at the end of history. And so this would be like a type gap prophecy. You see the same thing happening at play in Isaiah 13. It starts off just talking about Babylon, you know, 6th century BC Babylon and the judgment. But then it balloons out and starts talking about global judgment. And then it telescopes back in to talk about local 6th century BC Babylon. A type gap. It's the first installment, the next installment in the future, and then back to the beginning. Unforeseen partial fulfillment. Unforeseen partial fulfillment. This is where the viewer can see the ultimate fulfillment, but they can't see the part in between. This is often the church age. Is the church ever mentioned in the Old Testament? Answer, no. Not once. There's not one passage that talks about the body of Christ, the church, none of that. You have innumerable times where it talks about Israel or the nation or Judah, but it never talks about the church. And so you can see times where there's this ultimate fulfillment, where Israel and the church are together, one and the same, and yet there's this part in between the first and second coming, which you can't see. It's the church age. The prophet just jumps right to the future. Now, it's easy to think about these principles in theory. It's much more difficult when you do it in practice. And so one of our assignments for this quarter is we gave you a multitude of Old Testament prophecies which are disputed, which some people think refer to the first coming of Christ. Some people think they refer to the millennial kingdom. Other people think they refer to the eternal state, the new heavens and new earth. And you're going to have to go through those yourself and discover what is it that you think. Is this talking about the millennium? Is this talking about the second coming? Is this talking about Gog and Magog? Is this the one at the end of the millennium or at the beginning? It sounds like it's at the beginning. Why does Revelation put it at the end? And so basically what we're going to do is we're going to throw you in the deep end. You're going to cry. You're going to complain. You're going to weep and wail. You're going to go to Lowe's. You're going to buy sackcloth. And then you're going to get some ashes and you're going to wear it and throw it on your face. You're going to tear it. It's just going to be a miserable, miserable time. It's going to be awful. But through this exercise, you're going to start to get a flavor for how to handle Old Testament prophecy.